Welcome to the D Program, a desensitized look at sensationalized media. Here are your hosts, Angie and Sarah.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of the D Program. So glad you're joining us today. I'm afraid I have a little bad news to start the show today. My co-host, Angie, will not be joining us again this week. I know I had promised her return this week, but unfortunately, due to unforeseen circumstances, she is going to be off again this week. But I won't promise that she'll be back next week because I don't want to get burned by making that promise again. But hopefully, if all goes well, we do intend to have her rejoining us next week. So hopefully we can look forward to that. Before we get into the show today, I do just have to mention, because it was some red meat thrown at us last night, or yesterday afternoon rather, in the form of a very rare Biden press conference. I think he's done fewer than any president in modern history so far in his first year, but he graced us with a quite lengthy press conference, which was interesting. And I was able to watch a bit of it. And, you know, I have to say, aside from the content of his speech and the things that he said, just watching this man put together or attempt to put together sentences, I tell you, it's painful. It's painful to watch. But more importantly, it's just embarrassing. Some people have floated the idea there's an age limit on the young end. I think it's, 35 to become president. And at what point do we start seriously considering putting an age limit to cap it on the high end? I don't know what that age would be, 75, 70 something. But at a certain point, you have to start to wonder if this guy is competent enough to handle the crises that we face in this country today. That was a question posed to him, by the way. I think it was Rosen from Newsmax asked him about his mental fitness, and he seemed a bit annoyed by that question. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the press conference. It's just typical Biden stuff, what you would expect. But I will mention one thing and one comment he made that I think is really, and it's gotten a lot of headlines and a lot of people are talking about this comment. And I do think it is probably the most newsworthy comment he made. And that was when he was asked if he felt like he had overpromised. And his response was that no, he hadn't overpromised. If anything, he had outperformed. He believes he has outperformed in his first year as president. People are giving him a lot of flack for that, but I tend to agree with him. I do think he's outperformed. I mean, I would have never guessed that someone would have been able to destroy this country so quickly as he has on every issue he's touched. He did outperform my expectations. He's done considerably more damage than I could have anticipated a single person could have done in 1 year. So kudos to him. I guess he has outperformed in that respect, but we'll get into the show at any rate and talk about some topics. Some of them have to do with Biden, of course, but the first one I want to talk about is one that, interestingly enough, was not brought up at the press conference. Now, admittedly, I didn't watch the whole thing from beginning to end. I missed the first few minutes of it and kind of slipped in and out during it, but I don't recall, at least from what I watched, and I could have missed it, but I don't recall during the press conference him being asked any questions about the border, our southern border, which is astounding, really, given the crisis that continues to exist there. We just got numbers recently of the numbers of people that have been coming across the border in 2021, and it's record-breaking, absolutely record-breaking. According to Pew Research, more than 1.6 million encounters with migrants along the U.S.-Mexico border in 2021 alone, which is the highest ever recorded. So this has been a big problem. It continues to be a big problem. And in fact, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal back in November talking about issues that are important to voters. And the border is like number three behind the economy and COVID. So it's an important issue to the voters. And I think it continues to be an important issue, rightfully so. But yet it wasn't discussed at the press conference. So I find that a little curious. But here's the problem with the border issue is it's not just the border issue. The border issue affects so many other aspects of our life. it trickles into everything, really. So when people are concerned about crime rates, or they're concerned about human trafficking, sex trafficking, and we've talked about that a great deal on this show. When they're concerned about drugs, fentanyl overdoses, and drug overdoses, these are all issues that are largely impacted by our open southern border. There was another article, and this is in CNN, on CNN's website, on January 8th of this year. They report that the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency reported a 1,000% increase in the amount of fentanyl seized in the fiscal year of 2021 in South Texas. A 1,000%, actually 1,066% increase. And we're seeing record numbers of drug overdoses, over 100,000 drug overdoses last year, in 1 year alone. So this is a serious issue that is largely impacted by the border. The other issue that's obviously impacted by the border is voting rights. You know, voting rights is hotly debated currently. And now they've granted non-citizens the right to vote in New York, which is just absurd. It's insane. The way I look at this voting issue, and I'm probably in the vast minority and have a very politically incorrect opinion, but how boring is it to be politically correct all the time anyway, right? So the way I look at this is, you don't have a right to vote just by nature of your existence, of being born. It's not an inalienable right, like the right to life or to liberty. Voting is a privilege. We don't grant it to everyone. We don't grant it to children. So it's a privilege. And we've gotten really slack on what it takes to acquire that privilege. You know, once upon a time, you had to be a landowner. That was a roundabout way of saying you had to pay into the system. At that time, property taxes, I believe, were pretty much the only taxes. And so that was ensuring that only people that paid taxes were allowed to vote. You don't have to think too hard to understand why that would make sense. The problem is, when you have a bunch of people voting on what happens with money they didn't contribute to, yeah, their motivations are going to be a lot different. I think it was Milton Friedman who once said, and we talked about him on last week's episode. You should go back and listen to that if you're interested in him. But he once said that you can either have open borders or you can have a generous welfare system, but you can't have both. You can't have both. And that's what we have right now. And that's part of why we're bankrupt and $20 trillion in debt. To allow people that don't contribute, that don't pay in, that don't pay taxes, that instead and often cases receive tax benefits, voting en masse, and we're bringing in more and more people. What do you think is going to happen? Another quote comes to mind by Benjamin Franklin, who once said, "When the people find that they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the republic." So it's a dangerous precedent, but the people in power love the open border policy, because they can manipulate that vote. They can promise all sorts of goodies, and then that can keep them in power. The problem is, while it's good for them short term, it's bad for our country long term. Very, very bad. It will, as Franklin pointed out, herald the end of the republic eventually. It can't go on forever. And it's been going on for quite a long time. And, you know, we got to either make a change here or say goodbye to America as we've known it. If you were to ask me to choose, you know, you say you can't have an open border and a generous welfare system, so pick one. Frankly, I concur with Milton Friedman's choice in the matter, and that is leave the border open, shut down the welfare system. Because actually, when you do something like that, you turn the magnet off anyway. So mass immigration, if you don't have a generous welfare system, starts to be less and less of a problem. You get people that come here for the right reasons. They just want an opportunity. They are willing to work hard. They want the freedom to put in the work and live the American dream, but they're not coming for free handouts because, well, there aren't any free handouts. So we shut off the magnets, we shut off the problem, but we can't have the doors wide open and the magnets on and think that that's a sustainable path, because it certainly is not. Not to mention all the other problems. This was another question that was never asked of Biden that I heard, at least during the press conference, was the crime rate. The crime rates in our major cities are out of control, out of control. You have liberals in California arming themselves with guns as self-defense. I mean, this goes against everything they've espoused but they're in a position where they've had to kind of wake up and smell the coffee, and that the liberal policies in their cities have become dangerous to their welfare, and they have no other choice but to arm themselves. Not to mention, you have instances like what happened in the synagogue in Texas, the hostage situation that happened there last week. Now, I'm not sure how this individual gained access to our country. I have no idea if he came in through the southern border or not, probably not. But you have an open southern border and you're just ripe for more things like that potentially happening, especially when you have so many enemies around the world, as empires usually get eventually. So we got to do something with the border. And Biden obviously has no plan. The press won't even ask him about it, yet it's at the top of many voters' minds and the top three issues that are most important to them. But that was the first topic I just wanted to touch on, the border, because, you know, not a lot of people are talking about it anymore. It wasn't brought up in the press conference, at least that I saw. And it's still a big issue. It's still a big issue on voters' minds. And it's still important to a lot of the problems we're facing in our country. But we'll move into the next topic I wanted to talk about today, which is, of course, COVID. We've got to talk a little bit about COVID, given that that is still such a dominant issue in our lives. I mentioned that the narrative is starting to shift. You can see little hints of that here and there. Other places around the world, it's not so subtle. If you had a chance to watch Boris Johnson's speech he gave just yesterday or the day before, where basically in the UK, they are lifting everything. No more mandates, no more mask mandates anywhere, no more vaccine mandates, no more vaccine passports. They're done. They're all done with it. They've completely just ripped the Band-Aid off. And I think if you're going to go that route, I think you might as well just rip the Band-Aid off. I think that's the best way to go. So I want to play just a quick clip from Boris Johnson as he makes this announcement that they're rolling back all the COVID mandates with respect to masks and vaccine passports. He did say in there that businesses can still use the vaccine passport system voluntarily if they want, but they won't be mandated to do so. So, okay, fair enough, I guess. You just boycott the ones that continue to do this kind of nonsense. And also that the government will continue to suggest the use of masks, especially in certain situations, but will no longer mandate it and criminalize not using it. And I just want to play this one little clip of him making a couple comments on that.
In the country at large, we will continue to suggest the use of face coverings in enclosed or crowded spaces, particularly when you come into contact with people you don't normally meet. But we will trust the judgment of the British people. Anyone who chooses not to wear one.
They will no longer criminalize anyone who chooses not to use one. They will trust the judgment of the British people. Well, thank you for that. I guess here's a problem that I have. He's the same person who, over the course of the last 2 years, did not trust the British people, treated them like children, treated them like idiots who couldn't make decisions for themselves, who were too stupid or too naive or too incompetent to make their own decisions. And now he's getting cheers and accolades for deciding, well, okay, I guess we'll let you make your own decisions. Well, that's great. That's the way it should be. But this is the problem, is that these leaders in these countries, they think we're stupid. They think we're children, instead of as representatives of us and as beholden to us, that somehow they're in charge of us, that they're like a parent to us. And that is not their role. That is not what they're supposed to be doing. But to his credit, I guess, if he deserves any at all, hopefully maybe he's seen the error of his ways. He said that it's going to be starting next week, as early as next week, for some of these mandates that they're going to end them. Obviously, this is great news. Obviously, I'm elated to see this happening anywhere. And I think it should be happening everywhere right now. But I'm still frustrated, because I don't want to see these people get away with what they've done. I don't want to see them become benevolent dictators that we're grateful to now for granting us our rights back after they've trampled on them for 2 years. I want to see some accountability. I talked a lot about this last week. I'm probably not going to be 100% satisfied until we see some serious accountability from these criminals. But in the meantime, we need our rights and our liberties and our freedoms back. So the quicker they do that, the better it'll be for them, I guess, too. Hopefully, we'll see. But at any rate, that's what's happening in the UK. We can hope and pray that that sentiment comes here. And you're seeing it much slower, but you're starting to see it. There's a few holdouts. Fauci still seems to be holding out. Fauci and Biden seem to be digging their heels in. But everywhere else, you hear people like the CDC director Walensky and other places, media outlets and different places really starting to question a lot of this with respect to even the vaccines, the masks too, and boosters forever. Or is that really a good idea? So you're seeing more and more of people being allowed to at least start to question some of these things that were verboten. You couldn't even question it before. So, but then you have Biden at his press conference yesterday when asked about COVID. Still, his only response, his only answer to COVID is just vaccinate the world, more shots in arms, shots in arms, shots in arms. Like that's all he knows. But when you look around at some of these other places, there's signs of hope. There's signs of life potentially. So hopefully that will continue. Hopefully they'll get the message that if they want any chance of not being completely slaughtered in the midterms, they need to divorce themselves from this COVID fiasco that they've created. So we'll see if that continues. A couple of specific things I wanted to talk about COVID and some of the headlines that have come across over the last week or so. I don't know if you've been following the story of this Novak Djokovic tennis player who, I don't follow tennis, but he apparently is the one to beat. He holds all the national titles, all the championships. He's quite a skilled tennis player and was going to defend his title at the Australian Open. And as I said, I'm sure you guys have heard some of the stories coming out of that. They had granted him a visa. He was not vaccinated. He was unvaccinated and has no intention of getting the vaccine, but they granted him a visa to Australia anyway, because I suppose they wanted him to play in the Australian Open. And then when he arrived at the airport, they withdrew his visa. Then they held him in quarantine for several days, maybe a week or so. Then they gave back his visa for a minute, and then they took it away again and expelled him from the country. It was just a fiasco. It was a nightmare. And it did not leave Australia looking good. But I bring it up now because the headlines now are suggesting that refunds to the Australian Open are outpacing ticket sales. So now that he's not playing, he's not going to be allowed to play in the Australian Open, people are wanting refunds. They want their money back. They don't want to go, which I think is great. One of the headlines when they, for the second time, revoked his visa, one of the reasons they gave in some headline was that they didn't want him to become a symbol basically for freedom, but for unvaccinated people to drum up more support for unvaccinated. But in this whole saga, it was really them that, of course, shone the light on this and really magnified this into this great story. If they would have just let him in, all of us people who've never followed tennis would have never heard of the story, never heard of him, and never thought anything about it. But now he has become a symbol of freedom and standing on principle and doing what is right. Thanks to the Australian government for that. People are rightfully upset about it. They want their money back. So I thought that was interesting and hopeful. Okay. Another article I came across, I have to talk about. It was the most disturbing article I've read in some time. It comes from the Daily Wire. The title of the article is Salt Lake City Tribune wants National Guard to bar unvaxxed Americans from going anywhere. So this was an opinion piece that was written in the Salt Lake City Tribune. What they were opining about is that they want the Utah governor to use the state's National Guard to bar unvaccinated people from leaving their homes. These are our fellow Americans that believe unvaccinated people should be prisoners in their own homes. We talked on a couple different episodes about mass formation psychosis. This is it. This is it right here. And it's scary and it's dangerous. And these people need help. And I don't understand how you make a case for that even now. I mean, maybe once upon a time when everyone thought maybe the vaccines were going to work. But at this point in the game, I don't know how you make a case for that unless you really have a mental disorder. Here's just a small quote from that article. It says, quote, We are free, all right, free to fend for ourselves, to watch our children lose weeks, months, or more of their precious educational opportunities, to wonder whether it is safe to go to work or to the store or to sporting events, to see businesses close for want of employees or lack of customers. I mean, it doesn't even make sense. First of all, if businesses are closing for want of employees or lack of customers, lacking 20 or 30% of Americans in their homes isn't going to solve that. People that are scared to go to sporting events or to send their children to school, then they should be the ones that stay in their homes. There was this article from NPR. I'm sure you saw that this headline where NPR released an article suggesting that Justice Sotomayor hasn't come back to work in person because Justice Gorsuch was refusing to wear a mask around her. And she was uncomfortable around people who wouldn't wear masks because she's diabetic and, you know, has this pre-existing condition, but yet he still refused. It turns out, according to both justices, that that was fake news. That was not true. And NPR, I don't know where they got that or just made it up. But it is interesting because it is how a lot of people feel. It may not have been true in Justice Sotomayor's case, hopefully not. But there are a lot of people, and you hear that argument made a lot, is, well, what about people with autoimmune problems or underlying conditions? We have to protect people. So we all have to do all of these things to protect them. But here's the thing. No, we don't. We've never lived like that. We don't ask the majority of healthy people to stop living because there's some sick people. We take care of the sick people. We do what we can to accommodate them, but we don't shut down the lives of every single American. We don't do that. We've never done that. And it's not safe or healthy for anybody, them or the healthy people. So somebody who has diabetes often has diabetes because of personal choices that they've made. So the question then becomes, why should the choices that they made over the course of their life that led them to a diagnosis of diabetes affect me? Why should I suffer the consequences of their choices? So if somebody has diabetes and is concerned, they have multiple choices. They can stay home. They can isolate themselves. They can protect themselves in any way that they see fit, but they have no right to ask every other American to change their lifestyle because of a lifestyle choice that individual made. It's upside down and backwards. Thankfully, as I said, it sounds like this instance between Sotomayor and Gorsuch was false, but you have that mindset in a lot of people that the rest of the world owes them something. In this article that was written in the Salt Lake City Tribune, that, you know, I'm scared, so you all have to do something to alleviate my fears. Well, if you're scared, I can have sympathy for you and be sympathetic, and you're welcome to do whatever it is you think you need to do to alleviate that fear. But you can't ask me to participate in that. You can't ask me to shut down my life. We talked about this last week, the whole argument about vaccines, when we know that they don't stop transmission, is just moot. It's null and void at this point. So, and it sets them up for this false sense of security too. Even if you did this ludicrous idea of lock all the unvaccinated people away in their homes and not let them out to participate in society in any way, you're still going to have COVID spread around. So, you know, I don't know what you've solved here other than imprisoning a large portion of your neighbors and fellow American citizens. So this is a sickness. So yeah, and this is concerning because, as we've mentioned about trying to walk back these COVID policies, it's not just a matter of the policies, it's a matter of the sickness that has infected so many people. And I'm not talking about COVID. COVID is a lot easier to treat than this kind of mental disorder that these people have been inflicted with. So those were just a few stories I ran across that I thought were interesting and COVID related over the last week or so. And I want to talk about one other topic today. Since we don't have Angie with us, I decided to bring three topics today. And my third topic is about Jordan Peterson specifically, but it's really about a broader topic, just a cultural topic, really, about the Holy Trinity to the left, which is diversion, inclusion, and equity. Whenever you see those three words, which you see them often these days, it's usually synonymous with racism, sexism, and inequality. But I want to talk a little bit about an article Jordan Peterson wrote where he describes why he left the University of Toronto. He was a tenured professor there, and he decided to give that up. And he writes this eloquent article explaining his reasonings for doing so. And I want to dive into that a little bit today. So he gives a multitude of reasons as to why he gave up his tenured position, which are worth reading if you have the time, because they really pull the curtain back on what's going on in our university system. This is from the University of Toronto, but it's the same dogma that's being practiced in most of the universities here in the States as well. So it's relevant and interesting. But one point he makes that I want to dive into a little bit more is he talks about his concern with the diversity, inclusion, and equity policies at these universities and how dangerous and damaging it is. The reason I have such a problem with these policies, I think in a lot of ways is self-evident to most rational thinking people. But first of all, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We know that, but that's granting that they have good intentions. And I'm not so sure that they do, but we'll get to that in just a minute. But let's grant them for a minute that they do have good intentions and that these diversity policies and inclusion and equity policies are meant to give benefit to those who otherwise may have a disadvantage. That's not what happens though, when you start having these quotas and you start giving preferential treatment to people based on their sex or their race. What you get is lower quality candidates. You just do. I mean, if you're looking at something other than merit, then you're not going to get merit as the number one factor in your candidates. And what happens downstream from that is that you have lower quality everything. These might not seem like a big deal when you're thinking about, well, everyone should be able to go to college and get accepted to a college, but what is it they're studying? What are they going to get out in the world and do? And are they going to be the best qualified to do those important things in society, whether it's engineering or in medicine or in law or in technology? If you're going to get on an airplane, do you want your pilot to be the best pilot, or do you want to make sure he's the right skin color or sexual orientation? What matters to us? And are we seeing the death of merit? And the other problem that happens, that this is again assuming that these people have good intentions, but what they're not recognizing, perhaps it's subconscious somewhere, but when you start giving preferential treatment based on skin color or race, what you're displaying is your own soft bigotry. And what's more is you're seeing these policies begin to infiltrate not just the institutions of higher education in this country, but really every aspect of our culture. You see it in Hollywood, where they have quotas now as far as whether you'll qualify to even be considered for an Oscar. Your movie has to have a certain number of people of color. And even in the business world, where many CEOs and companies are now instituting these training sessions to exercise from people's any implicit biases they may have, which is just ridiculous, because first of all, that's assuming we all agree that people have these implicit biases in the way they're suggesting, or that these implicit biases that people have are always and automatically negative and terrible and need to be exercised from individuals. So I haven't even agreed that that's true. But even if that is true, that the idea that a seminar or some training session by some snot-nosed HR rep is going to fix that or change that has certainly never been proven. So why are we going through this whole charade to make us feel better, to wear our virtue on our sleeve, to show the world how progressive we are? But all of it's nonsense. None of it is based on anything tangible or scientific. It's just a show. There's nothing of benefit that comes from doing this. This is a recipe for disaster. This is not going to work. It's not helpful to anyone. And it's harmful to a lot of people and to our society as a whole, as we watch once great institutions crumble under their own weight. And nobody knows this better, ironically enough, than Putin. Going back to the Biden press conference for a minute here, He was asked extensively about Russia and Ukraine and the disagreements that are going on there and what may result from that. So I guess it's timely to bring up Putin here for just a minute, but we'll talk about him in a much different context here because he recently gave a speech. In fact, Jordan Peterson references it in this article he wrote. So I went and dug up the whole speech. And with respect to this topic of diversity and equity and inclusion, and how on its face it sounds wonderful and lovely, it has a much sinister motive. And I will go so far as to say motive, because while I'm just for the sake of argument granting them a good intention, I don't for a minute believe that the people that are pushing this do have any intentions that are good. So then you ask, but what is their aim then? What are they trying to accomplish? And we don't have to look very far back in the history books to see this tactic and how it's been used previously and what the result was. In fact, Putin knows very well why it happened, what happened, and the result. And he references it, ironically enough, in a speech he gave recently. And so I want to read you verbatim some of the text from his speech. And I want to read a couple of good paragraphs, so bear with me as I go through this, but I think it's really fascinating to hear from his perspective what he thinks of this, what he sees. And you can check the history books on this and fact check him. I encourage you to do so and see if what he's saying is accurate. But this is what he had to say about some of this progressive left-wing diversity, inclusion, and equity nonsense. This is what he said. He says, "The advocates of so-called social progress believe they are introducing humanity to some kind of new and better consciousness. Godspeed. Hoist the flag, as we say. Go right ahead. The only thing that I want to say now is that their prescriptions are not new at all. It may come as a surprise to some people, but Russia has been there already. After the 1917 revolution, the Bolsheviks, relying on the dogmas of Marx and Engels, also said that they would change existing ways and customs, and not just political and economic ones, but the very notion of human morality and the foundations of a healthy society. The destruction of age-old values, religion, and relations between people, up to and including the total rejection of family, we had that too. Encouragement to informed on love ones. All this was proclaimed progress, and by the way, was widely supported around the world back then and was quite fashionable, same as today. By the way, the Bolsheviks were absolutely intolerant of opinions other than theirs." He goes on to say, "This, I believe, should call to mind some of what we are witnessing now. Looking at what is happening in a number of Western countries, we are amazed to see the domestic practices, which we fortunately have left, I hope, in the distant past. The fight for equality and against discrimination has turned into aggressive dogmatism bordering on absurdity. When the works of the great authors of the past, such as Shakespeare, are no longer taught at schools or universities because their ideas are believed to be backward, the classics are declared backward and ignorant of the importance of gender or race. In Hollywood, memos are distributed about proper storytelling and how many characters of what color or gender should be in a movie. This is even worse than the agitprop department of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Countering acts of racism is a necessary and noble cause, but the new cancel culture has turned it into reverse discrimination." He goes on to say, "The obsessive emphasis on race is further dividing people, when the real fighters for civil rights dreamed precisely about erasing differences and refusing to divide people by skin color." I'll just finish this portion of his speech with this quote from him. He says, "In a number of Western countries, the debate over men's and women's rights has turned into a perfect phantasmagoria. Look, beware of going where the Bolsheviks once planned to go, not only communalizing chickens, but also communalizing women. One more step and you will be there." Those were Putin's words recently. It is interesting when you look at where this obsession with diversity and inclusion often leads. I'm not sure who it's supposed to benefit. if you're concerned that not enough people of color or certain demographics are achieving the highest rungs of our society, then you start at the bottom and you provide them the tools necessary to get there. You don't let them cheat their way there. You don't give it to them in any other reason but because they earned it. If you give it to them strictly because of the color of their skin or their sexual orientation or their gender, you have not done them any favors. You've only proven yourself to be a bigot. Again, I don't think it doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help the individuals. It doesn't help our culture as a whole, especially in the long term. It certainly doesn't help. Imagine being an artist of any kind and being dictated to as to how to create your art. That negates the artwork altogether right out of the gate. It stifles it. It stymies it. It changes it. Just imagine the art that would have never seen the light of day had these kinds of policies been in place a generation or two ago. It saddens me to think of what we would have missed out on. And it saddens me further to think that if these policies continue like this, what future generations will never know, will never see, will never develop because of this. I don't see the value of this, of these policies at all. So hopefully things will turn around. To bring this topic to a close, I will say that Jordan Peterson he begins by talking about how he left his tenured position at the University of Toronto. And as I said, he describes several reasons why he chose to do this. But one of the things he discusses is that he's better able to teach people without the stifling rules and policies that make it almost impossible for him within the university, but he's able to do so online and through speaking engagements. So there's some benefit to different technologies we have available today, and hopefully they remain free so we can continue to use them to circumvent these systems that seem intent on destroying themselves from the inside. Which brings me to actually my good news topic, which kind of goes hand in hand with this. So I'm going to get right into the good news topic I have for you today, talking about the universities. And I've been watching carefully what's been happening at the universities. As I have said, I've got one child at a university now, one a senior in high school preparing to head that route, and a third one on his way. He's a freshman in high school currently. So I've heard the horror stories and the warnings coming out of what's been going on at the universities for quite a while. And the problem I've always had is, okay, but what are the alternatives? I don't want to send my kids to these places, but what is the alternative? One such opportunity I came across was an opportunity that developed in North Carolina in several of the private schools there by a gentleman by the name of Robert Luddy. What Luddy has done is established a number of engineering careers and technical education programs at various private high schools in North Carolina. It's similar to trade schools, but it's a little different in that they start training these kids in high school. And by the time these kids are 15 or 16 years old, many of them have earned certifications that hold with them the opportunity for jobs that make between $40,000 and $60,000 a year. So decent money for a 15 or 16 year old. But instead of going right into a job after high school, if they don't want to do that, they can go into a traditional college program or continue to go on to one of North Carolina's paid apprenticeship programs, which often incorporate free college into the training. One of the problems with college is we've talked a lot about the cultural problems that we see in the universities with what's exactly being taught in there. But the other thing we don't talk about a lot is the debt that's incurred by so many university students. The student loan debt is a whole nother crisis in and of itself that's not easily solved. But in this particular case, he's enabling students to be able to do some paid apprenticeship work or get a good paying job that can help pay for colleges if they want to do that or continue with the program where they will help with the college tuition as well. And they're really great in demand jobs that this program is training kids for. It's just a great alternative to the four-year education that costs $100,000 and leaves you with not much of an education, but a lot of debt. So it's a great program. And I'd love to see more of this kind of thing, these kinds of options and different opportunities for young people to immerse themselves in. So I think this is a great thing, especially in context of it's young boys that are struggling the most in universities. The statistics couldn't be clearer on this point. So this is a fantastic workaround from that system for these young boys. So I love to see it. I hope to see more of that. So that's my good news story. The high school apprenticeship program at some of the North Carolina private schools created by Robert Luddy. Hopefully we see more of that. All right. With that, we'll start to wrap up the show here today. I will finish it up with my quote of the week. Today, I decided to do a quote from Jordan Peterson, since we discussed him today in the show. And I'm a big fan of his. I'm actually going to see him live in February. He's doing a speaking tour coming through my state. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to that. But the quote I chose from him for this week, I thought was relevant to the topic we discussed. So this is from Jordan Peterson. He said, "I've studied authoritarianism for a very long time, for 40 years. And they're started by people's attempts to control the ideological and linguistic territory." So I think that's relevant to the conversation we had, because the first thing they do is they start to change the language. And you see that happening in our culture right now. They're changing the language all the time. It's hard to keep up with all the new terminology that they come up with. And it's their attempt to control the linguistic territory. I think they must feel like if they can change the way we speak, they can change the way we think. And I'm not sure they're wrong on that. So it's very important, according to Peterson, that we stand our ground on our linguistic territory. We stand up for free speech. We don't cede our language. It brings up another interesting thing I didn't really include as a topic, but it did pique my curiosity this week. Was I'm a big fan of Matt Walsh. I don't know if any of you listen to his podcast. He does a great podcast every day. One of the few that I listen to really regularly. And he actually went on Dr. Phil. He talks a lot about cultural issues. He talks a lot about transgender issues and those kinds of things. And so he went on Dr. Phil, believe it or not, the talk show, those still exist for those of you who still watch TV. But he went on Dr. Phil and he was on his panel with these transgender people and had quite a heated debate and discussion. It's worth checking out if you're interested in that. But he's advocated for that for a long time. We don't have to give up the language we know and we use just because someone's feelings get hurt about it. It's not to offend anyone, but it's a recognition that when we start to cede our language, that's the first step towards authoritarianism. And people who have studied this very carefully for a long time warn about this. And you see that this was some of the first steps that other people around the world throughout history have used to usher a society towards authoritarianism. So anyway, that's my quote for this week. That's all I have for you for this show. I'm very hopeful Angie will be back next week. I'm pretty sure she will be. So please tune in every Friday for more from the D Program. Until then, check out our website at www.thedprogram.net. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Gab. Other than that, have a great Friday, have a great week, and we'll see you back here next week. Until next time.
Cheers.